Okay, today we're going to start with some announcements, and then we're going to very briefly review about how the S4 voltage sensor moves, which we largely covered last time, but at the end it was a bit of a rush. And then we're going on to vision, which is something that Michael here knows a heck of a lot, and so we'll see if I make a mistake or not. First, with the announcements, today is April 21st, so there'll be a lecture as usual. In fact, on Wednesday and the following Monday, there will be lectures as usual. I think I've decided on one of the lectures to cover some biology, which is sort of basic biology, but it would be good that you've at least been exposed to it. Okay, on Wednesday, April 30th, our last day in class, that will be you will present your final talks, as well as in the evening, 6 to 8 p.m., and once again, I will have pizza, and you'll give your talk. For any of you who are nervous or whatnot, you can always eat your pizza after.
Should there be 364 rooms below?
Oh. Yes. Okay. Then on Friday, which is the day after the last class, you'll have your take-home final exam, which you pick up in 364 Loomis between 4 and 6 p.m., and then you turn it in that following Monday afternoon, May 5th, by 5 p.m. Is there a particular problem with this? Okay. The only thing is, it is a final exam that is take-home, since that's what everybody uniformly wanted. While it is take-home, it is closed book, closed notes. And I expect you to be honest. And at the end, you need to turn in your final exam, because I don't want it released. And not to make copies of it, and you'll be asked to sign a statement saying you've not made a copy nor shared the test or answers with anyone. Again, Monday, May 5th, 5 p.m., you turn it in again to 364.
And the one below. Friday, right. May 9th.
Okay. Okay. And Friday, May 9th at 5 p.m., which is, I think, actually the last time I can allow you to turn anything in, you should turn in your final papers. If you want, you can send them electronically as, you know, PDF or Word documents. That is also fine, though make sure that you hit the button before 5 p.m. Is there any questions about this? Yeah?
Would you send them in? Do you want to send them to you or to Dylan?
How about both? Finally, the last homework we have, well, there's a homework due on this Wednesday, and then there's a homework due on Monday the 28th. It involves basically reading two articles. One is by Pancho Bezzania, How Membranes Proteins Sense Channels, and it's a review article, but it's really very good. Another article is a review article about single photon detection by rod cells of the retina by Fred Ricci. And we'll go over a fair amount of this information today. And then you should write a half page on each article. What was the major point? What was one thing you did not know? What question do you have that is unanswered? Questions? Yeah.
So for the 10-page paper, we don't have a specific format, just write basically a summary of our presentation, or just explain as best as we can the topic.
That's right. And also, you want to have significant background there, so you understand what the problem is that they're trying to answer. Why are they trying to answer it? I mean, those are big things. Then once you have that, then you go into how they actually answered it and if there was any technique involved, what the technique is, and then what is their conclusion. So for any of you came in late, that this will all be on the web. Okay. So we're now going to first just really very rapidly review what we said last time in terms of how ion channels, in particular in this case voltage-gated ion channels, and in particular how the shaker potassium ion channel reacts to voltage. And we have over here, which is the crystal structure of the open conformation. So this is the picture that I showed before, where S5 and S6 are inside. They form the pore where the ions flow through here. And then S1 through S4 is shown over here, and those are the voltage-sensitive channels. And in particular, S4 is the primary one that senses voltage because it has positive charges, namely arginines and lysines to a certain extent. And they feel a tug of open or closed. And now the most obvious tug would be a translation, but in fact, Rod McKinnon thinks that indeed there is a very large translation. We happen to disagree. And this, I should mention over here, is a sideways view. What actually happens is he crystallized not only the membrane portion, which is right over here, which is the side view of this, but in fact, he crystallized what is called the T1 section and also the beta subunit sections, because you have to remember that this is a tetramer, and so there needs to be something which allows it to not dimerize, tetramerize, and in fact that is the beta subunit over here. There's also that's enough. Okay, so McKinnon, this is based on the open conformation. We don't have a closed conformation, so there's a question of how does it go from open to closed. And what we've done is we've done some FRET, or more accurately, Lorette measurements. We've taken the S1 through S6, which is one quarter of the total. We've placed a series of labels over here, and we watched the energy transfer from a donor to an acceptor. There was certain problems associated with oocytes, that they had a lot of autofluorescence, and we had problems where we wanted to see the donor and acceptor complex uniquely, not the donor only, not the acceptor only. So for that we used Lorette, and we could isolate the acceptor due to energy transfer. And what we found was that in certain ones, like right around over here, in 351, 352, and 353, they actually underwent a certain unusual voltage dependence. Namely, in one case, it got somewhat larger. In another case, it basically stayed zero. In another case, it actually got closer together. All of these, I should mention, is on the order of one angstrom. So it appears that the motion is very small. And in fact, the once particular residue, I think it was 346 over here, matched the voltage gating very well and moved a total of 3.5 angstroms. So everything is saying very small distances. And this, you can rationalize how this looks by if you say 351, 352, and 353 are all in an alpha helix that looks like this. And 351, 352, 353. And what happens is they undergo a rotation. And in that case, initially, 351 is far apart. It undergoes a rotation. And then 351 is the closest. 352 is over here, it undergoes the same rotation, and in fact 352 doesn't change at all. And similarly, 353, which starts out as closest, undergoes a rotation and then goes to be the farthest. Okay, so what the short answer is, we found that the voltage sensor, it twists, and that it does not translate very much. Now, in fact, we know that the thing has to translate somewhat, because somehow these arginines, these charges, have to move, somehow be connected to the inside potential, move, and then have to be connected to the outside potential. Because we said that there are 13 electronic charges, or about 4 per each S4, that essentially moves in the voltage. And so, the fact that they move as a function of voltage, in fact, let people have the initial thought that it's just some linear motion. Since our results say it's rotational motion, we still have to come up with a means to make it from the inside to the outside. And in fact, we do this by, we say that there are certain invaginations in the membrane allowing it to, both on the inside and the outside, come very close to each other, and simply by a rotation it moves it from the inside to the outside. And in fact, we think that there is on the order of 4 to 7 angstroms in some recent work, which actually is a translation. So it basically goes like this with a very small translation. Okay, and what we're not going to get into very much is this over here is a sort of more recent model of how the S4, or the entire channel, moves. This is the S4 over here. Here is the S6 and S5, and this is in the closed state, and this is in the open state. And in fact, in Pancho Bezzania's article, he in fact goes through this, and you'll be able to read quite a bit about it. Okay. So that's sort of a summary of the voltage-dependent gating. Is there any questions? Okay. Now I think we're going to switch to vision, and this is fundamentally how we're going to do it in terms of we'll study the basic structure of the eye, we'll talk about making an image, then we'll talk, this is really crappy. I guess that's, it's the way it is. We'll talk about the sensitivity of vision, and in particular, can you see a single photon? That's really interesting. Why you can't see stars during the day, and the signal to noise, and then how light is converted into electrical impulses or nerve impulses. We'll study some of the molecular biology of that. And of course, it involves, as you can imagine, ion channels. Okay. So this is your basic vision template. Obviously, two eyes connected. The light comes in here. It's converted into electrical signals. And then actually it comes together and the vision is actually somewhat mixed in that what you have here, the left side is combined with also the left side over here and goes into your left optic tract. And similarly, some parts of this connect to the right side here and go into another optic tract. It turns out that I had a problem in that I had a lesion in my optic tract. It was really bizarre. I remember thinking, something sort of weird. And so I went to the medical doctor. And I'll never forget this. The guy put up his hands and said, how many fingers do I have up? And I said, he did something like this. He said, how many fingers do I have up? And I said, one. And no, he said, in total, how many fingers do I have up? And I said, one. And he said, oh, okay. how many fingers do I have up now? And I said, one. And it was really bizarre. And what had happened is essentially I had lost my vision in my, fortunately I forget it, in my bottom right-hand quadrant. Everywhere else was perfectly normal. Like they could then do a vision test where you go and you look, and there are like little stars going off, and you press a button saying when you can see them. And if a star went off here, it was fine. Over here, it was fine. It was here, it was fine. Over here, it was completely gone. Just completely gone. And in fact, it was in the right quadrant of both eyes. Because, in fact, it was in the lesion was in my optic tract. And I guess I don't have the MRI. I did get a copy of it, and you could see something right there. And just for some bizarre reason that occasionally people have it. I had a lesion there, and after a couple of weeks or maybe a couple of months, it just went away, and I could see again. And then, of course, not only does it go the optic tract, it then, of course, ultimately is processed in nerves in the back of your brain. Okay, and this here is the eye. Of course, the light comes in here through the pupil, which is basically an opening in your eye, and the light goes in over here and then ultimately hits your retina, which contains a lot of the rods and cones, which are what actually does the light sensing. One thing about this is that there are a ton of blood vessels in your eye because they use a tremendous amount of oxygen. And in fact, they use such a tremendous amount of oxygen because it turns out that these ion channels are among the most active cells in your body in total. And you'll see why that is. Okay, so the basic structure over here is you have rods and cones, which ultimately go and form in the optic nerve. What you have here is you have the aqueous humor, which is sort of water-like, and then another water-like here, and the lens, which is a somewhat different index of refraction. So water is about 1.33, and the lens you have is about 1.42. And that's good because by varying the shape of this, you can vary the image distance, and the image in this case is formed over here. You have a blind spot, which is the entrance to your optic nerve. Has everybody, is there anyone who hasn't seen the blind spot? It's really great. What you do, everyone do this, is, let's see, how does it work? I guess you close your, close your left eye, and about have your arms, you're straight, and then it's important to keep looking straight, and then move it slowly, and your finger will disappear. See it? No. Yeah. Keep it about here. Okay. No? Make sure you're staring straight out. And there, it's gone. Does everybody see it? Do you see it? No. You don't?
It's gone here.
Here. Okay, turn around and look at the blank wall. Put your finger out. You close one of your eyes. Let's say, keep your right eye open. The left eye is closed. And then slowly move it. And don't let your eye follow it. Right. Did you do it?
Yeah, it worked.
Shouldn't it be at some angle, though?
Yes.
Like higher than that or lower than that? It's not a zero, right?
No.
This is zero when you look straight out, right?
That's right.
So should it be going down?
No. The angle is a little less than 20 degrees.
Oh, is that a top here?
No, it's right there. It's right there. Turn around and make sure you stare at the screen. It's very easy, very tempting to keep looking at your finger. Did you see it?
Yeah.
Or did you not see it?
Well, yes.
You have to do it slowly because it's not a huge area. No? Come here. What we do is we chop off the finger. Then come on. Everybody should have this experience.
I think I've seen it sometime before, but I just can't do it right now.
Okay, so stare at the wall.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You're staring not at the wall, yes?
Yes. I still see the finger.
the top of. The nail, for example, the top of it.
The only thing was that you have two spots.
Okay, I see it. Oh. I saw the top half came off. Yeah.
Are you doing this just to make me happy?
No, I actually saw it.
You mean you didn't see it?
I actually did.
No, you didn't see it.
Well, I mean. Yeah, I saw it disappear. It was like...
Sit down.
What?
No. Okay. So, did you see it? You really did. So, everybody seen it? Yeah? Okay, there you go. Okay. The reason is, because obviously... that there is a blind spot. Oh, and by the way, a really amazing thing in terms of, you know, at one point I lost a quarter of my vision and couldn't see. What the brain does is it goes and it interpolates such that, you know, I didn't know that I was missing a quarter of my vision because my brain made things up. Yeah. Okay. Two things five things to notice. In your eye, you actually have two lenses. One is the so-called the lens. The other is, in fact, the cornea, which is different because you have N equals 1 over here, and then N of higher, more like 1.3 or something like that. And so you actually, light comes in here, and whenever it sees a difference in index of refraction, it's turned slightly, and then the lens does the final little bit. And in fact, the cornea, actually, the amount of light that is bent, or the percentage of it, it is like two-thirds on the cornea and like only one-third on the lens. One is the image distance. Second is the image distance is fixed. Third is in the normal eye, the object is infinity. That is, if something is way far away, that is, that then it's focused on the retina with the lens completely relaxed. Okay, and the light and color detection is clearly a function of position. And the fifth thing is the rods and cones actually face backwards, in that if you, this, for example, is right here where the light is coming in, it has to go through all of these cells before it hits the rods and the cones. Okay. So how does it work that the image is formed on the retina? How does Snell's law work? You probably know the formula, which is, you know, N1 sine theta 1 equals N2 sine theta 2, where theta 1 is the angle off of the perpendicular. What I always do to remember what the theta 1 and theta 2 are is imagine that you're riding your little tricycle and you're on the sidewalk. Okay. Let's see if I have another pointer. Okay, so here, of course, you're going straight, and then what happens is this wheel hits the grass, and so initially is going more slowly. This keeps going just as fast, and so it turns more into the normal over here. So in this case, so it's N1, this relation corresponding to the speed, times sine theta 1 is equal to N2 times sine theta 2. And so what you have is you have light coming in here, getting bent, then getting bent some more, and forming a focus. Okay, so the amount of bending depends on the index mismatch and the angle of incidence, and what I said before is the cornea is responsible for 2/3 to 3/4 of light bending. So why can't you focus well underwater? I mean, if you go underwater, everything is out of focus. Why is that? Yeah?
Because the light isn't being bent as much.
Why isn't the light being bent as much? Yeah, when it comes to your eye, but in particular when it comes to what part of your eye?
Of the cornea.
That's right, of the cornea, which says, and so it comes in, and then why doesn't your lens adjust and make it in focus? Does most of it. Basically, the lens cannot do it. So that says, basically, you can't focus because your cornea, instead of being going from 1.0 to 1.33, it stays essentially at 1.33 the whole amount of time. Okay, so then why, what can you do about it? In terms of going underwater. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You wear goggles. And so then you have air, or an index of fraction of 1, going in, and your eye can focus. What does it mean to be focused? That you want to focus something so that it's focused on your retina.
Yeah,
What does that actually mean? Yeah.
But the focal point is falling exactly where the rotating cones are, so I'm falling before it.
Yeah, and what is the focal point?
Depending on how much the lens is
curved. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, the light rays intersect.
All the light rays intersect. Were you going to say something?
Where the image is formed.
Where the image is formed. Yes. And that, let's say you had a very small object. When will this be in focus? Where the lens goes and reforms the image to exactly a point. So if your retina was in fact over here, it would not be in focus. So a point on your object goes to another point in the image plane. So now I have a question. Why is image form upside down but not left to right? In that, what happens when you take an image, for example, of your face, it lands on my retina upside down. So if you have an object like that, it actually forms upside down. And then your brain is what turns it around. Okay. First, why does it form upside down? Yeah.
It's a consequence of how the lens is
formed. Mm-hmm. That's right. You have something like this. And your retina is right over here. Okay, so it's a consequence that essentially it's like one lens. Okay, so now what about left and right? If you want to know the truth, I'm a little confused about this. So your right hand, if you have a guy pointing in, it seems like over here that it would correspond. So right hand, it would correspond to this one. So why doesn't your brain have to do a flip in terms of left-right? This is an actual question that I have. Because it doesn't. Does everybody understand the question? Okay. Does anybody have the answer? Because I see over here, it forms this, my arm, upside down. We agree with that. And it seems to me that it's on the left side of everything. Do you know, Michael?
I actually didn't know that was occurring, because I thought if you moved that point just like in a circle, then you trace in opposite directions. So I thought it was actually right to left.
Because if you look at the drawing you made on the right, if you see that that's a top view instead of a like a side view, then it flips it left and right.
So you're arguing that the brain flips not only things upside down, but left to right. I don't know. It's my understanding that wasn't the case, but maybe it is. I don't know. Okay. Okay, there are two types of photoreceptors. There's rods and there are cones. And the rods are very good at seeing a very small amount of light. And there's an enormous amount of them. There's typically 10 to a rod cell over here typically contains about 10 to the 8th rhodopsin molecules, and rhodopsin is the actual chemical which does the change, which we'll talk about over here. In fact, so rhodopsin is a pigment that absorbs the light. It changes the shape. It essentially goes from bent to either straight or bent. And then ultimately it leads to a single ion channel and a nerve firing over here. Cones, it turns out, are sensitive, in fact, to the color, which is, in fact, how you get color. Okay, and this here is a view of a retina where over here the rod cells are over here. The light is coming in here, and it's backwards. Okay. And in terms of why that is, it just may be some consequence of neuronal tissue development. And as I mentioned, these are very metabolically active in that they're near the skin cell or the epithelium cells where they can get oxygen and nutrients. Okay, they've actually isolated an individual rod and done patch clamping on them, and you can see that it goes from nothing up here to actually you can see the voltage or current on an individual ion channel cell. Okay, as I mentioned, the rods and cones are not in any way uniformly distributed on the retina. The rods are about have maximal at about 5 millimeters away, or it turns out is about 18 degrees over here, and the cone cell right here is maximal right about zero. Okay, so for maximum sensitivity in low light, where should you look? Yeah. At what angle? Where does it correspond?
I guess like 20 degrees.
Yeah, something like, well, a little bit less than 20 degrees. So if you're at night and you're trying to see a really faint star, what's best to do is not to actually look at it, but to look a little bit away, about, you know, something like 15 to 20 degrees away, and then you can actually see it. Okay. Not only are the amount of cones and rods, here's rods and here cones, but in fact, you see that their distribution is not the same. right here, you get a whole bunch of cones, and right over here, you get a somewhat lower density. Okay, now it turns out that the eye does visual perception itself. It's not completely in the brain. In particular, what you have is you have rods or cones, and you have about 20 or 15 to 20, 25 of them. They all come together. Their signals add in terms of they go into 5 to 6 diffuse bipolar cells, which then add and then goes into ganglion cells. So effectively, what I say is there's about 10 to the 8th photoreceptors, about 10 to the 7th intermediate cells, and then about 10 to the 6th ganglion cells. And the ganglion cells then all add up into your optic nerve. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Another interesting thing, which actually I don't know why, but you have the photoreceptor going here is a horizontal cell. And then horizontal cells and other processing makes visual responses more sensitive to differences in light intensity in an image than absolute light intensity. So apparently what they've done, if you sit in a room that is completely uniform, has light in it, but it's totally uniform, that after a while, you'll perceive it as being completely dark. I don't know how they've actually done this, but it seems amazing. Do you know?
I mean, if you walk in the snow for a long time, you'll get blind. That's the reason people go to north or south part, they wear something, sunglasses. Otherwise, if you walk just in...
That's more reflection of the ice burning your eyes.
Not as burning. Not burning, I think. It's just you get blind. You cannot see anything.
Well,
you try to bring it to a normal level, and then you can't see darker things because you've normalized the super brightness. I mean, I guess that doesn't explain why you see darkness because of uniform.
Yeah, it seems to me under that circumstances, you know, there may be like a person walks up and you wouldn't see them because you're trying, you know, there's so much light and you know you're trying to maximize the difference and you can't see that. But yeah, you're saying that you'll actually see dark.
It's a disease. You cannot do that. That's this. Your eye will be permanently hurt if you do it long time. You cannot see anything after that.
Well, I mean, clearly, if you shine a laser or whatever into your eye, after a while, you won't be able to see. You know, presumably, your rods and your cones will be burnt out. But that's not what I'm talking about in terms of. Apparently, if you make it, uniformly light, that you'll see zero. You'll think that you're in a dark room.
It seems a lot like chemotaxis, where bacteria will always want to swim with the gradients. What they do is they renormalize their sensors to the level. So their sensors always going up to normal out the baseline or down.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
I forgot which one, but either one of the rods or the cones, they saturate once they're under constant light, and I think the cones don't. So one of them saturates, and I guess maybe that's why they produce just darkness after a while. Then they're saturated and they can't absorb any more light, and they.
I see.
Do something like that.
So you're thinking that when a person is sitting in this uniform room, that the intensity of light would have to be very great in order for them to see zero?
No, just I read that either, I forget which one it was, either the Rods or cones, they saturate after they've been exposed to light for a long time, that means they can't respond anymore. So basically maybe that's why, I don't know how it would go darker, but one of either the Rods or cones saturate after a long time of exposure, they can't respond anymore.
I see. Well, my cousin actually does eye research, so I realize now maybe I'll ask him. Okay. This has to do whether you can see a single photon or not. Okay. That you can see over an enormous range, something like 10 orders of magnitude. And that, for example, there's about 100 photons per square micron per second hitting your eye when you're looking at starlight. To something like 10 to the 8th photons per square micron per second in bright sunlight. So you can actually see this. So it's fairly amazing. And at something like 10 to the minus 4 photons per micron squared per second, you have some sense of light and dark and can navigate a bit. So if the photoreceptors, in this case a rod, because this is, again, rods are the most interest for seeing small amounts, is about 3 micron diameter, this corresponds to 0.004 photons per rod per second, or about 1 photon per 250 rods per second. So you can see an amazingly small amount. It turns out the integration time is about 0.1 seconds. So that says you can see one photon per 2,500 rods per 0.1 seconds. That is really pretty amazing. And, okay. So looking at starlight, which is apparently, it's about 100,000 photons per second. So what that means is in starlight you have about 2,800 visible photons per second per millimeter squared hits the surface of the Earth from the North Pole. So in your pupil, you figure it's what, you know, 5 millimeters or 6 millimeters, so about 40 millimeters squared. So that's 112,000 photons per second. Wait, how did I get that? Hits the surface, photons per second per millimeter squared. Oh, essentially times 40, the size of your... That's right. Times 40, the size of your pupil, that's about 112,000 photons per second from the star, times 0.1 seconds, which is the integration time. So that's 11,200 photons per, essentially, shutter time. Okay. Now, that's the number of photons hitting your eye from this star. Okay, but then there are losses that go through the eye. It, you know, if a photon is here, does not necessarily equal to your, it reaches your retina. And that only about 10% of the photons that hit the front of your cornea actually get absorbed by a photoreceptor. And only 2 out of 3 of these photons lead to a chemical reaction. That is, if a photon hits your rod or your cone, there's about a 2/3 chance that it'll actually send a signal. Okay, so basically, just going through this, it turns out that, it's about 6% of the photons entering your eye actually create a signal. That is, you have about 10% of loss in your cornea. Then you have a 42% loss through the vitreous humor and the pigments. and then one out of three entering the outer segment of your cells gets absorbed, and then two out of three photons actually lead to a signal. So the bottom line is you get about 700 photoisomerizations in 0.1 seconds, or about 6% of the photons entering your eye actually create a signal. And the way they create a signal is they hit this retinal over here, which is initially bent, and it causes it to be straightened out. So effectively, what is the light is caused by their summarization of the retinal. And well, why don't we, we'll go through a little bit of the molecular biology, and then we'll actually go and review the initial experiment that says, can a person see a single photon? And it turns out that it's a pretty tricky measurement to do that. So why don't we take a 3-minute break right now, and then we'll come back and do that. Does it actually affect downstairs?
I don't know. Maybe not.
Okay, so let's go through the experiment of can you see a single photon? This is an experiment that was done by Hecht. Has anybody taken? He's written a famous textbook. You've had the. Okay. Okay. So this is the experimental arrangement. You take a short, dim light flash into the average into the eye of an average of n photons, and you ask the person, "Did you see it or did you not?" And you keep reducing the light intensity until you can't see it. Now the trick is how to know whether the absolute number of the photons. So in terms of the light flash, you measure the average number of photons at the cornea by what's called a thermopile. What essentially that is it takes the electromagnetic light and it converts it into heat. And by knowing the amount of heat, you can get an idea of the average number of photons. Okay, you want to maximize the sensitivity. So the first thing you do is you shine about 20 degrees off center, because we said already that that's where it's maximum. The flash time, remember it's like 0.1 seconds is the integration time, so you actually shine at much less than that, because you want them to see potentially a single photon. So you, instead of being 100 milliseconds, you actually shine it about 1 millisecond. The flash color is about 510 nanometers, which is the blue-green. This is 532 right here, because it turns out that that's where you're actually maximally sensitive. The spot size, okay, that gets a little trickier. Turns out that if light is less than 10 minutes of arc, the receptive field, you get a maximum sensitivity. And that is, if you shine at such that it hits the retina at bigger than this, you have somewhat lower sensitivity. And finally, you do dark adaptation. That is, if you go in a dark room, in this case, for 30 minutes, in his case he actually waited 40 minutes, your eye is something like 2,000 times more sensitive than if you're in a bright room. Okay? So we're giving a series of flashes of an average number of n photons per flash entering the cornea. And they say yes or no, and this is what they get. And it looks like this. And so it says, on average, you can see about 120 or so photons coming into your eye. So if you say just what I did, you define that as the threshold of seeing, then we get a 0.5. Then we say 100 photons or 50 to 100 photons, depending on the person. Then if 10% of the incident photons are absorbed, you can see something like 5 to 14 absorbed photons, and about 2/3 of the molecule get excited, so you can see 3 to 10 or so excited molecules in the retina lead to a signal. So there's two things to make out from this. One is you cannot see a single photon in terms of it requires something like 100 photons in terms of entering your cornea. However, if you look at it a slightly different way, you have 3 to 10 excited molecules lead to in the retina lead to a signal. It turns out that area is about 500 rods. Quite a few. So the probability that two photons arrived at the same rod is very small. And this I get from Hecht. We may therefore conclude that in order for us to see, it is necessary for only one quantum of light or photon be absorbed by each of 5 to 14 retinal rods. That is, this number of photons over this rod, meaning a photon absorbed by one of 5 to 14 retinal rods. So your eye is just amazingly sensitive. It's not so sensitive that it can see a single photon coming at your eye because of the absorption and so forth in your eye, but you can see on the order of 100 photons coming in. And what that means is, in terms of, you have one photon for every 5 to, let's say, every 10 retinal 10 rod cells. So your eye is really amazingly sensitive. But in fact, why can't we see a single excitation? And the answer is that the photopigment spontaneously isomerizes in the absence of external light. You have your rods. And there's some probability that this will spontaneously go from bent to straight. Turns out that actually it amounts to 5 spontaneous excitation per receptor field per 0.1 seconds. This creates, in effect, a dark noise. So if you were in a completely dark room, you would say that, in fact, there is a certain amount of light, in fact, hitting your eye, when, in fact, there is actually zero. And so in order for you to see an external signal, it must be on this order or 10 times to see it. So mammalians have about a single rod has about 10 to the 8th rhodopsins. So a rhodopsin spontaneously isomerizes actually every once every 300 years. But because there are so many of them, you actually do see a signal. And so in each rod, you have one rhodopsin isomerizes every 90 seconds or so. So one isomerization leads to the rod firing. If 500 rods in the visual field, you get 0.5 isomerizations per integration time. And then each isomerization leads to a nerve firing. Okay. So the bottom line is it's always a matter of signal to noise. And in this case, the noise is not zero because the rhodopsin spontaneously isomerizes, which causes a nerve to fire, which you think is, in fact, a signal. I think I'll talk for 5 or 10 minutes next time about what the molecular biology of how you go from a photon being absorbed and a rhodopsin going from bent to straight, and which ultimately leads to a molecule, a nerve firing. Okay, so why don't we have the class evaluation?